A question for you. What makes a real Christian, or a real Muslim for that matter? As we know all too well, for as long as there have been religions, there have been rules about who's in and who's out. The great split in Christianity began 500 years ago exactly, when Protestants changed the Catholic rules. And for the next 130 years, Europe was consumed by war and bloodshed. Now, Michael, I read something like a quarter of Europe's population was killed in the post-Reformation religious wars. How do you get your head around a number that extraordinary?
Well, first of all, you have to remember there's a secular side to these wars. This isn't just a matter of religious struggle. There are kings versus emperors. The famous 30 Years' War, which is a diabolical and disastrous war in the 17th century, which is often seen as a sort of the prime example of a terrible religious war, included people from different religious perspectives in alliance with each other. You could say it's the birth of the nation state that really causes the violence in there. Though, having said all that too, there are religious motivated violent actions that occur in that 200 years.
It does eerily remind one of contemporary Middle East, the interplay of geopolitics with religion, with people at the rough end of the stick.
In some senses, though, I'm reluctant to make that analogy because you're obscuring, in doing so, the remarkable events that occurred in both Catholic and in the new Protestant churches in those eras, and also a movement which sparked a cultural and intellectual enrichment and political enrichment, which we're still benefiting from today. If you're a secular liberal, the roots of secular liberalism take place in the religious changes that occur in the Reformation. So the foundation of the printing press, producing vernacular religious materials, the Bible being translated into English, the spread of literacy, the education of women.
That was all on the Protestant side. And what were the advancements on the Catholic side?
Well, the Catholics in return in the Counter-Reformation became a much more advanced missionary movement, social welfare works, the Jesuits are founded. So in order to sort of win that propaganda war, you might say, they invested in some of the great artworks that we now have in Western and indeed Central Europe.
Can I ask you, Michael, does individualism have its roots in the Reformation? Like, we often look at it as an Enlightenment invention, the importance of every believer being able to read and understand the Bible for themselves. Like, it's a much more individualized thing that isn't supposed to be mediated through
an institution. No, yeah. Exactly. So there's a sense in which a rising middle class in Europe wants to get hold of its own spiritual experience, and that's part of the Reformation message. Every believer is addressed by God directly, and so the Protestant idea of the priesthood of all believers comes to the fore. Also, it's the end of the monastic movement in the Protestant lands, and so you don't kind of have two tiers of Christians where you have special spiritual people
and then the rest of us.
Yeah. What happened in the monastic era?
Well, in the monastic movement, you had vast monasteries, a vast number of people living the monastic cloistered life, which was a specifically religious life dedicated to religious practices and disciplines, and they did remarkable things as well in the sphere of learning and the universities. But when those are closed, what happens is Martin Luther, the great reformer, starts to speak about the sanctification of ordinary life, that holiness is not something just for people who wear bald heads and brown cowls, it's for people working in the fields. And he's got this great passage where he talks about a father changing nappies, and that this work, stinky though it is work done to the glory of God, that is sanctified by prayer and by being dedicated to the glory of God.
So religious life isn't just Sunday, but it's Monday through Saturday as well.
Yes, you put it very directly.
But in terms of the individual though, which doesn't exist before then in the way that we use it, it's plucking them out of their network of relations and kind of saying, no, it's you and God. This is the inheritance that we claim when we talk about the importance of every human being. But the individual, does that have its roots?
Absolutely. It emerges from that spiritual insight. And the story of Martin Luther is instructive there too, because he can't figure out how he is a righteous Christian, how he's found forgiveness. And yet through his spiritual experience and through his reading of the scriptures, he discovers actually it's through faith that I'm saved, not through believing certain doctrines and not through doing certain actions.
Or paying the Catholic priest.
Or certainly not by paying for your salvation to be procured through indulgences, yeah, which was the kind of corrupt practice that was going on at the time.
Well, to learn a little bit more about the differences between Catholics and Protestants, we can now draw upon the help of US comedian Stephen Colbert, who, for the record, is a Catholic, but I think you'll get that idea.
Protestants don't make me angry as much as disappointed, although they do make me angry. Unlike the world's crazy made-up religions, they're so close to getting it right. They're a single pope away from reaching their full potential. But instead of stepping up and making a commitment to one holy apostolic church, they're stuck on this notion of independence, of unmediated faith in Christ. Do you really think God prefers a mess of polyglot, disorganized prayers over the elegant handwritten Latin epistles of Benedict XVI? As if he didn't have enough to do already without putting your request for an above-ground pool into babblefish. So we get it, Protestants. You've had your 490-year protest. Let's move on. Martin Luther was probably right to translate the Bible into German, and I'll grant you, he may have had a legitimate beef about selling indulgences, but let's stop living in the past. Whenever you're ready, we'll let you back into eternal salvation. All you have to do is say a few Hail Marys, plus I've got some bargain basement relics you might be interested in. I'm talking rare primo St. Elbruff shinbone.
What about that? Are you tempted, Justine? You want that shinbone?
No, not into it at all. I think
Mary Magdalene's skull, which is in France, apparently.
Right, right. Yeah, not interested.
Relics don't do it for you?
No, I don't like the idea, I have to say, that there's something other than God's grace, basically.
I should mention that's Stephen Colbert reading from his book, I Am America and So Can You. Why do you like that there's not other things? What's wrong with art or statues or other things?
I don't know. Art and statues are fine.
I mean,
absolutely.
Religious art and statues.
Oh, in that sense. Right. Well, if you're talking about as a thing to mediate the presence of God, I just look at that and I'm like, but I could have put that together if I trained hard enough. And what use is a God that I can make out of the work of my hands?
Well, what if I, just for argument's sake, had here what I could prove to be a splinter from the cross or a nail? Surely that would move you.
Well, it would move me. I wouldn't venerate it, though.
you too, Michael, you'd be moved, but you wouldn't venerate?
Yeah, that's exactly my approach. There's a key theological difference to do with objects, and Protestant Christians actually said, no, that doesn't seem to be the way in which God communicates. In fact, he communicates through the word. Luther said, the ears alone are the organ of the Christian, and so we're supposed to be listeners, not lookers, so that if you go to a typical Roman Catholic church, especially a Baroque one, it's extremely ornate, and there are lots of statues, there are places which you can venerate the statues, especially of Mary, and I'm not saying that they worship in the same way that they would worship God, but there's a veneration, you can light candles to that, what have you. In the Protestant churches, especially in Switzerland, not all Protestant churches, but in Switzerland, they're almost bare. The stained glass windows aren't there, they're clear. And in the centre of the church is not an elaborate altar, but a table with a Bible on the table. And the pulpit is really the centrepiece. So that tells you that there's something very different about the approach to Christianity going on.
Justine, is your church like that?
We've got a bit of stained glass action going on.
And having said that, Michael,
so does mine.
Yours is old and pretty sandstone.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it being pretty.
And it also had Elton John married there about 25 years ago,
and
I wouldn't be getting all
pure Muriel,
on me.
And Muriel also got married there, which was about as effective as Elton's first marriage.
I would want to ask, though, Michael, like, can you spell out, does that mean that there is a turn away from aesthetics as well? Like, I don't want to worship something, but I want to be able to have some sense of the beauty of the transcendence, which doesn't mean that I look to it as God's talking directly to me. But surely the way that we appreciate music or the way that we are brought to tears by a sunrise or something like that, that speaks of elements of his character and what he's like.
Yes, and you're right, but in its right place and informed by that centrality of the word, and especially that centrality of believing in the gospel about Jesus. I mean, Bach, as we went to Leipzig and saw where Bach worked, and Bach, of course, is a Lutheran Christian, and he puts Luther's theology to extraordinarily beautiful music and the Bible in German to extraordinarily beautiful music so that people not only understand it, but aesthetically appreciate it.
Mm. So why is that okay, but the Sistine Chapel from Michelangelo isn't?
The thing about the music is that it actually was a setting for the words. And so there was a particular function they had. Cranmer, in the English Reformation, he rebelled against choral music where you would say one word but over several notes and no one could hear what was being said. But he said, no, I want choral music where there's one word per note so that people can
understand. But that's not a turn away from aesthetics, but it's a particular means by which the aesthetic is used.
So, Michael, what does iconoclasm mean?
Iconoclasm is a word that refers to a movement that's cropped up at different times and different places in Christian history where people have actually smashed statues and images. There was quite a bit of this going on in Switzerland. This happened in 1523 after Zwingli, the reformer from Zurich, preached. People came into the church and smashed the images and got rid of the statues.
And did you see evidence of these things on your tour?
More often you see actually evidence of the attempt to restore them. The evidence is the absence of the images that are there. But you can in Europe certainly see defaced images. Statues have had their faces scrubbed off.
Hundreds of years ago.
Yes, back in the time of the Reformation or even in the century afterwards. And this happened across Europe. And in fact, there's a great Dutch word, Beeldenstorm, which means statue smashing, the statue storm. And it's a word to describe this thing that broke out across Europe, including in 1566, especially in the Low Countries, where churches were kind of purged of these idols. Now, I've got to say...
And your tour guide said this was a great tragedy as he looked at plinth after plinth and area after area where these great artworks, testament to humanity, had been desecrated.
Yes, and I think that's a quite 21st century way to think about these things. That these things, we think of things as works of art, but the idea of art is actually quite a sort of post-romantic thing. These images had a particular ideological function, and there was a move to change what was actually the furniture of your religious building.
But cutting to the chase, you supported the idol smashers of the 1600s, just like the Taliban smashed the giant Buddhas of Bamiyan.
Well, not just like.
Not just the Buddhas. Sure, there's...
What happened, it is a particular part of the history of the Reformation, of the history of the church, and it is making a religious, a theological and aesthetic statement. It's not anti-art or anti-beauty. John Calvin, the great Swiss reformer, everyone thinks is entirely drab, wrote very positively about art and science, but not in church. In church, that wasn't the function of art.
It's probably important to mention at this point that people are illiterate, right? So they would have received the majority of their theological education from this religious art. And so it's very hard to not worship the medium in some ways in the midst of all of that. So the defacing is a way to correct that, right?
It's a radical way to say we're making a break and now we're going to teach everyone to read and we're going to give them a Bible in their own language. Interestingly, Luther, one of his assistants, Karlstadt, actually tried to smash the idols and got this going in Wittenberg while Luther was actually hiding out, hiding away from the Pope, who was trying to kill him at the time. And Luther actually had to come out of the castle and go down to Wittenberg and say, hang on a minute, these people are illiterate. They need to learn. And so he was much more moderate in the way in which he treated the images in his churches. The other reformers were more radical and said, no, if we don't get rid of them now, then people won't understand. They won't make the switch. I mean, they were now going to hear words in church in their own language for the first time, and they had to be focused on that.
Have either of you been to a synagogue?
No.
Yes.
It's kind of like a Protestant church.
It is, and it's interesting that both...
not ornate, that is.
That's right. Mosques, likewise, they can be very ornate, but they don't contain images. Solomon the Magnificent, who was the emperor of the Ottomans, he actually sent a letter of approval to the Protestants in the Netherlands in the 16th century because he said, well, fantastic, the Christians are getting rid of their images. It's interesting that the monotheisms is true in Judaism and true in Islam, but much more mixed in Christianity.
And Justine, what do you feel when you find yourself in a Catholic church or a church that is very ornate with all the statues and the stained glass and overdoes it?
I enjoy it, I have to say. Like, I find it's quite mysterious.
Enjoy it like a museum or enjoy it spiritually?
No, I don't enjoy it spiritually, but it does give you a sense of the otherworldliness of the divine.
You didn't feel like getting a sledgehammer and...
No, I'm...
Showing them what's what?
No.
Bringing a bit of 1600 action on?
No, I'm not violent.
There was a lot of just plain out vandalism.
Teenagers with skateboards. Now, Michael Jensen, you were in the exquisite and beautiful Westminster Abbey, one of the most important centres of Anglicanism in the whole world. How much did you love it?
Didn't like it. I liked going to see historical sites. I liked seeing Queen Elizabeth's tomb and Queen Mary's underneath and all that sort of stuff. Historically very interesting. But it felt to me like a temple to political power. It felt to me like, you know, it had been a substitute for the old way of the medieval Catholic Church, and in the spaces that had been carved out, they'd put instead powerful people, successful people, basically a place you go to worship the British Empire.
There's a statue for Benjamin Disraeli there.
Yes, there's Disraeli and Gladstone, and they're all great, you know, interesting and noble people, like Poets' Corner.
Don't you think the world would be a better place if more churches had statues of Jews?
Well, a lot of churches do have statues of at least one Jew and probably many others.
And so, you have a problem with that?
Well, not because they're Jewish, though.
So you say.
Yes. you got me. That's right. No, so I thought interesting how political power can really be one of those things that floods into the vacuum. And I think we're in an era in which people are now seeing political power as a means to delivering on what we want.
I know, how extraordinary that Obama was invested with that messianic expectation, and now Trump is seen as a similar messiah for, you know, the other side.
Yes, I'm longing for the era of boring and very human politicians where we can elect flawed people who will stay and make very dull speeches.
Haven't your prayers been answered already?
Where?
Well, dull speeches.
Well, Trump is anything but dull.
Oh, I was thinking in this country.
no comment.
With that, we have reached the end of God Forbid. Justine, Michael, thank you very much. I've had a wonderful time.
Thanks very much for having me, James.
It's been really good. Thank you.
I have learnt a great deal about history, the present, and even a little bit about the future. Now, Dr. Justine Toe, the Senior Research Fellow at the Centre for Public Christianity, and Dr. Michael Jensen, Rector at St. Mark's Anglican Church, Darling Point, Sydney. He got one soul through the door last time he was on.
Update, one extra soul.
One extra soul.
There are lots
of
souls.
One extra, yeah. No, it was standing room only. And we'll update you on the turnstile activity in future weeks. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the God Forbid podcast on iTunes or the ABC Radio app. You can email me at godforbid@abc.net.au. That's godforbid@abc.net.au. Until next week, remember to be good. God forbid.